Yesterday, we had one of the best experiences I've had the entire year. We had a Bible study reunion. Most of you guys know that I was with Youth for Christ for a really long time. I was a volunteer for Youth for Christ for several years, and then I was a staff member for about like 7 years. And one of the best things that Youth for Christ ever did, and it was a great thing, it was called the Young Adult Bible Study. Now, the Young Adult Bible Study is what it sounded like. It was a Young Adult Bible Study. What we did was we would go to one of the youth centers, and we would sit down, and we would go through the text of the Bible. We would just sit around in the couches, and we would read a passage of Scripture. We would read one story at a time, and beginning in Genesis, reading every single one of the at least the most important stories in the Bible, we went through the entire narrative of the Bible week by week, and we would talk about it, and we would ask 5 questions. What do we like? What don't we like? What do we learn about people? What do we learn about God? And how do we apply it to our lives? We did this for hours every night. Now, we also played Mario Kart and a lot of games. It was a lot of fun. Late teens and 20-somethings can stay up pretty late at the youth center. There were a lot of times we beat the sun up, but hey, it was a great time, and we finally had a reunion. We had some friends that were back from Florida. They came to our house, and it was such a great time. All of us got a little bit sunburned. I was telling Fred about that because we were outside all day. You can't have like 40 people at our house and everybody fit inside, but we had a great time. And sure enough, after just talking about kids and stuff, we did what we love doing most, which is we started talking about the Bible, we started talking about our faith, we started talking about theology. And this sermon came up. And I said, well, I'm preaching about the virtue of chastity, and I'm not really sure how to preach it. And I asked my friends, I said, if you were going to church and you heard somebody was talking about the virtue of chastity, what would you want to hear? Now, most people looked at me thinking that this was a trick question, and they didn't want to say anything, so they thought, I better not say anything. But my friend Anna, whom I love, and I don't see her enough because they live in Florida, but Anna spoke up, and she said, I know what I'd want to hear. I said, okay, what's that? And she said, I would want to hear something about our feelings, about the things that we want, about our longings. And I said, okay, keep going, what do you mean? Well, Anna's family is a church-going family. She grew up in church, and so did her whole family. And she said some things that I actually kind of knew, but I wanted to hear her say it. And she said, well, my sister, and there are young ears in here, so I'll use some euphemisms, but my sister has attractions that she knows are not godly attractions. And she has these desires that she knows are godly, that she knows that are unbiblical. And she's decided that she doesn't want to struggle against these desires anymore, that she doesn't want to fight against them anymore. I said, oh. And her brother has gotten into, I don't know how these things happen, but has gotten into the world of polygamy. Like sister wives, that whole thing. Now, a lot of you are rolling your eyes, and I know some of you watch the show Sister Wives, so you know what I'm talking about. But this is what they're interested in. And she has said they have these desires, they have these longings, they have these things that they want that they know either are clearly unbiblical, or you could make a defense of it, but it's really not a good defense. It's not a good biblical defense. And she kept talking, and I was really interested in what she was saying, because Anna's a really sharp lady, and she was going on, and we had a really nice conversation. But I thought, man, she's right. She's right. Because here's the thing. When we talk about chastity, and I know it's an old-timey word, and I know it's a word that makes people feel uncomfortable, I know it sounds old-fashioned, but when we talk about this, there's a tendency for us to only think that chastity is a negative virtue. It's about what you don't do, right? If you are chaste as a single person, it means you are reserving all sexual congress for marriage. You are not engaging in it. It's something you don't do. I don't do this, therefore I'm holy. I don't do this, therefore I'm pure. Right? It's a negative virtue. And if you are married, your sexuality is retained within that marriage. In your actions, your thoughts, your longings, all of that is retained within with your spouse. It's a negative virtue. Chastity is about what you don't do. If you don't do bad stuff, then you're chaste, therefore you're virtuous. That's typically how we view it. Now, a lot of people, some of you probably grew up in churches like this, where all of the virtues were negative virtues, right? How do you know you're a Christian? Well, I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't cuss, and I don't, you know, plow my hay, or I don't mow my hay on Sundays. That's what being holy is. That's what being virtuous is all the stuff you don't do. You know you're a Christian because you don't do the bad stuff, or at least you don't do the bad stuff that the preacher says you can't do. I'm that makes me good. But see, I don't think that that really cuts it. I don't think that that demonstrates virtue. It's certainly part of it. Yes, not doing evil is not doing evil, and that's something we need to strive for. That's a minimal requirement of being good, is to not do evil. But the idea of virtue is more than just not being bad. It's about actually being good. It's not just that you don't do something. It's that you do something. There's a very famous movie, and it was an old movie. It was a Leslie Nielsen movie, and I think you guys will forgive me for the joke, but Leslie Nielsen was playing a priest, and he comes, and there's a young man who comes up to Leslie Nielsen's character, and he says, "Father O'Malley, Father O'Malley, I really love your books. I love your writings." And he's like, "Well, thank you, young man. I appreciate that." And he says, "Well, Father O'Malley, I, like you, have kept my vow of purity. I've kept my vow of chastity." And the Leslie Nielsen character, in true Leslie Nielsen fashion, says, "That's very good, young man, but unlike you, I kept mine by choice." And he was quite a nerdy young man. I guess you have to see it for it to be funny. But anyways, there's this idea of, if I don't do something bad, then I'm good. But that's not the case. Not having the opportunity to do evil doesn't make you good, right? I've never robbed a bank. That doesn't make me good. I wouldn't get away with robbing a bank. I'm not fast enough, right? Just because you don't do something evil doesn't make you good. I've never launched a missile strike against another country. That doesn't mean I'm good. I've never had the opportunity to do it. What we need to focus on is not just the deed, not just the doing of good, not just the doing of evil, but there's something deeper, because how can we look at chastity? How can we look at this virtue, and how can we find something positive about it? Now, I don't mean positive in the sense of good and beneficial. I mean, what is the positive aspect of it? Because again, we look at it as though it's a negative virtue. I don't do this, therefore I'm good. So is there anything good about it? Is there any actual good that we can do that's not just not doing bad? I believe there is. Because as my conversation with Anna reminded me, and it reminded me of ancient church fathers, there is something, and that is our desires. It is not enough to simply not desire evil, but we must desire good. We must have desires for things that are good, things that are holy, things that are righteous, things that are uplifting, things that make us like Christ. It is not enough. Again, I know I'm repeating myself a lot today, but I want to make sure we hear this. It is not enough to just not do evil. Moreover, it is not just enough to just not desire evil. We must desire the good. One of the great church fathers said that the real heart of Christianity, the heart of our faith, comes down to this. The problem with humanity is that our loves are disordered, and Christianity reorders our loves. A similar way of phrasing this, which many theologians have done, our desires are out of order. We have disordered desires. We desire what is wrong, and we don't desire what is right. We have a longing for what is bad, and we do not have a desire for what is good and righteous and pleasing. That is our problem. In a nutshell, the problem with the Christian life, the reason why so many Christians struggle to live a victorious Christian life, the reason why so many Christians make a hash of their Christian life, the reason why so many Christians stagnate in their Christian life is because they believe, as I believed for a very long time, they believe that the Christian life is about the acquisition of knowledge. That if I learn enough facts, if I get this book, if I can find one, if I get this book and I read it long enough and I study it deeply enough and I memorize enough of it, that somehow that will make me a good person, that will make me a holy person, that will make me a Christian. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work because the Christian life at its core is not about knowing things. The Christian life is not about thinking rightly, it's about loving rightly. It's about having our loves ordered, oriented correctly. It's about directing our love first and best towards God. We reread Deuteronomy 6, right? Deuteronomy 6, the first thing Moses says about the law, what is the first thing he says? Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall study this Bible and you shall memorize at least one verse a month. And if you keep doing this long enough, O Israel, the Lord God shall bless you in the land that you are in, and the Philistines will all just go away. No, that's not what my Bible says. I mean, this isn't my Bible, I just grabbed it. But that's not what this one says either. The Bible does not say, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall watch many YouTube videos. And you shall take notes on the YouTube videos. And then the Lord shall bless. No, it doesn't say that either. It doesn't say, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one. You shall go to Sunday school class. And you shall take diligent notes in the Sunday school class. And you shall look at your notes later and not just take notes one time and never look at them again. It doesn't say that either. Now, none of these things are bad. Please hear me. None of these things are bad. Memorizing the scriptures is a very good thing and a necessary part of a good Christian life. Watching other preachers, don't just watch me, watch good preachers too. Listening to good sermons is really, really important. Listening to the word of faith preached is really important. Going to Sunday school is really important. All of these things are true, but at its heart, the core of our Christian life, the core of our faith is this: Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God. Love Him. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul, with all your strength. Love God. That is what God is calling us to, is love. God did not create us as robots. God did not create us as automatons. God did not create us as servants. He created us in His image so that we could love Him and be loved in return. That is why we were made, for love. And the problem we have is that our loves are disordered. That the love we should direct towards God, we direct towards self and the things of this world, which is idolatry. The problem is not that we love self. You have to have a real self-love. You should love yourself, but you must love yourself in proportion. You should love the things of this world in proportion. You should love your children in proportion. Jesus says, no one who loves father or mother, son or daughter, brother or sister more than me is worthy of me. You must hate them. Jesus is not saying you need to hate your kids. He's not saying tie them up to the radiator and just leave them there because you hate them so much. I know we've all been tempted, but that's not what he says. That's not what he means. He means that by comparison to our love for God, we must hate our children. Doesn't mean hate them. It means that our love must be prioritized. To hate means to disprefer. We must prefer God over. We must love God more. And at the heart of love is desire, brothers and sisters. Our desires must be ordered rightly. Now, there are three ways that our desires can be ordered. Three ways. We can desire what is evil. We can desire what is good disproportionately or out of order, and then we can desire what is good in its right place. There is a desire for evil. Read the scriptures. Sodom and Gomorrah, there's a desire for evil. Is there not? The story of Amnon and Tamar, there's a desire for evil. Is there not? The wicked queen Athaliah destroying her grandchildren so that she could be queen. Some people just desire to be evil. Some people revel in doing bad. And this is innate in the human heart. Every human being is born with a desire to do evil, to do what is bad for the sake of doing bad. And you say, Luke, I don't know, that sounds a little crazy. Even little kids, oh, especially little kids. And I can prove it to you. I can prove it to you in 5 minutes. Here's how. You take a child about Micaiah's age, maybe a little older, maybe a little younger, and you carefully build a tower of blocks, and watch what that child does with it. They will smash it to pieces, and they will gain great enjoyment from it. One time when Phineas was maybe 3 years old, he worked for, I mean, a long time for a kid, like 10, 15 minutes, building this really nice tower. And Eliza came up, and Eliza thought it was the greatest thing in the world to just come up and smack that thing down, and a down it came a-tumbling. And Phineas, in his anger, he didn't hit her. He just said, ah, and he just walked over her. I mean, like literally, he just like walked over her, like he walked into her. She fell down, and he just kept walking in his rage. He should love his sister more than he loves his stupid block tower, and she should not gain a grotesque enjoyment out of just destroying something good. But anybody who's been around children knows they like breaking stuff. All of us just like breaking stuff. That's part of living in a fallen world. That's part of being a sinner. There's a part of us that loves what is evil. There is, and if you think that you're exempt, I promise you, you're not. Talk to anyone who knows you. If they're honest, they will tell you. You have evil desires. Now, there's also the much more common thing, which is to desire what is good, but out of proportion and out of place, out of time. To desire what is good and right, but to either place too high a value on it or to take it when it's not ready. The tree in the garden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That was not an evil tree. Desiring the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil was not a wrong desire. It was a good desire. Knowledge is good. The knowledge of good and evil is good. How do I know? Because God has that knowledge. And God put it in the garden so that people could eventually eat from that tree. But they desired to have it in the wrong time and in the wrong way, contrary to the express will of God. There was nothing wrong with desiring it. There was something wrong with taking that fruit before the appointed time. I know some of you guys are history buffs. Bill, you're a history buff, I know. Have you ever read the book Out of the Wilderness? It's a local history book. Out of the Wilderness is a local history book. And it's written about the Amish Mennonite settlers who founded Central Mennonite Church. It's Orlin Greaser wrote it. I have it on my shelf if you're ever interested in local history. Orlin was a really clever guy, and he had a good way of working with euphemisms. And one of the things he talked about was the pioneers, you know, they came from Switzerland, they came here, and they had a problem. One of their problems was clearing the Black Swamp was an enormous amount of labor. Running a farm like that was a huge amount of work. And to do it, you had to have children. You had to have children. And to marry somebody and be incapable of having children would guarantee that you would have an ineffective farm. And Orlin very delicately points out that at that time, if you look at the genealogical records, for some reason, there was a rash of children being born 2 months premature. For a very long time, there were children being born at 7 months. Very consistently, children being born at 7 months after the day their parents were married. Ah, now the wheels are turning. We're all catching on now. 2 months was enough to know and maybe not get caught until people start doing the math, but then, you know, the horse is bolted, so there's not much you can do about it. The desire was good. The desire to have children is good. The desire to be married is good. The desire to enjoy the blessings of the marital bed are good. The desire to do that outside of marriage is to twist that desire and make it something that it's not supposed to be. I could keep adding on example after example after example, but you guys get the picture. What happens in this world is we take desires that are good and we corrupt them by putting them where they shouldn't be, by either giving them too much importance or by taking them when we don't have the right to. The last example I'll give of that is this, perhaps the greatest example. The desire for glory is not a bad desire. Jesus promises that his saints will be glorified. We will share in his glory. This is a repeated promise that the Bible gives, that we will share the glory of God. That is not a wrong desire. If you want to share the glory of God, that is good. The problem is, sometimes we desire our glory more than we desire to glorify God. We would rather that we receive the glory of God. It is not wrong to desire glory. That is not a bad desire. It is not wrong. It is wrong to desire glory more than we desire to glorify God. And the chiefest example of this would be Satan. The enemy of our souls, his fall was not brought about because he just loved bad things. And he thought that like snakes and bats were cool and he wanted to hang out in a fiery pit and thought that was fun. No, Satan was driven to his sin because he desired something good, but out of order. He desired his own glory more than he desired to glorify God. Lastly, most importantly this morning, we have good desires. The desire for good things. And this, brothers and sisters, is really the heart of this message. It is good to say no to bad. It is good to say no to things that will defile us, that things that will make us impure. It is good to do that. But that is the minimum. The minimum is to say no to evil desires. The minimum is to say no to desires that are out of order. But we must, if we want to become like Christ, we must say yes to good desires. We must cultivate good desires in our own souls. Good desires are there. Psalm 45, one of my favorite psalms in the Bible. What do we say? God has anointed Christ. God anointed Christ. Because he loves righteousness and hates wickedness. He loves what is good. Example after example we could show in the Bible of people having a desire for what is good. Perhaps the greatest example is in the upper room. Jesus is talking to the disciples. And they tell him, Lord, show us the Father, and that will be enough. They wanted to see God. That is a good desire. Brothers and sisters, what I am telling you this morning is rather on the nose and rather obvious, but it needs to be said. Living a virtuous life in many ways comes down to the cultivation of good desires. Because here's the thing, and this is what the society, this is what our culture won't tell you. Our culture, you could hear a good psychologist, a good unbeliever tell you most of the things I'm going to tell you today. Here's what they're not going to tell you. Your desires are under your control. Your desires are under your control. We, brothers and sisters, can change our desires. Now, I know everybody who looks like me has been told that if they would quit eating sugar and stuff, that eventually your flavor palate would change and you'd stop liking sweet and salty things. That's a lie. That's a lie from Satan. That is not true. That never happens. Your palate doesn't change. I still like potato chips. Like, I've tried. I really have. I've tried. It hasn't changed, okay? Salad is still gross and stupid, okay? I have tried. That's a lie. But what we can do, we can change our desires. We can cultivate good and godly desires. We can change it so that we long and desire what is good and right and pleasing to God. We can do this. And you say, Lukey, but how? By prayer. by an appeal to the Holy Spirit, by praying that God would give us good desires. There's a song, I love it so much, it's not in the hymnal, but it's a song that has changed my life. And by the way, that's part of what songs do, is songs help us cultivate our desires. Some of you might know it. Lord, I am fondly, earnestly longing into thy holy likeness to grow, thirsting for more and deeper communion, yearning thy love more fully to know. Open the wells of grace and salvation, pour the rich streams deep into my heart, cleanse and refine my thought and affection, seal me and make me pure as thou art. Dead to the world would I be, O Father, dead unto sin, alive unto thee. Crucify all the earthly within me, emptied of sin and self may I be. Open the wells of grace and salvation, pour the rich streams deep into my heart. Cleanse and refine my thought and affection, seal me and make me pure as thou art. I would be thine and serve thee forever, dead unto sin, alive unto thee. Crucify all the earthly within me, emptied of sin and self may I be. Open the wells of grace and salvation, pour the rich streams deep into my heart. Cleanse and refine my thought and affection, seal me and make me pure as thou art. That song is a prayer, as many of the great songs are. A prayer that God would cleanse and refine our thought and affection, that God would give us a love and a longing for what is good. Brothers and sisters, that is my prayer for us today. That we would desire what is good. We would desire what is pleasing to God. That He would cleanse and refine our thought and affection. That He would seal us and make us as pure as He is. And we know how He did it, how He paid for it, how He made it possible. Christ is able to crucify our thought and affection because He was crucified. It wasn't just a metaphor for Jesus. Jesus was nailed to the tree. He bore our sins in His body. He paid for sin. He set His desires on what pleased the Father. He wept in the garden, Father, if it's willing, if it's possible, take this cup away. But not as I will, but as thy will. Jesus crucified His own desires so that He could desire what the Father desired. And He set for us an example that we should be like Him. He set for us an example that we should live a life where we ourselves are broken, where we are poured out so that we can be resurrected into the image of God. He gave us that great example, and He calls us to remember that on the night He was betrayed, He took the bread and He broke it and He gave it to His disciples and He said, take this, all of you, and eat it. This is my body broken for you. And when supper was ended, He took the cup. Again, He gave God thanks and praise and He said, take this, all of you, and drink from it. This is the cup of my blood, the cup of the new and everlasting covenant. It shall be shed for you and for many so that sins may be forgiven. Do this in memory of me.